I'm Justice Bill Meyer, and I'll be your presiding justice for this oral arguments. And Second Court of Appeals will hear oral arguments first in two cases, then a break, and then a third case. So if the clerk will call the court to order, we'll proceed.
The court will now call Dr. Jesse Smith, M.D. versus Crestview UV LLC et al. May it please the court, Aiden Wiles will argue for the appellant. Brian T. Davis will argue for the appellee.
Are the attorneys ready? Then we'll proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
Justices, good afternoon. My name is Eamon Wiles, and I represent Dr. Jesse Smith, who is a local plastic surgeon based here in Fort Worth, and he specializes in reconstruction of the face and the neck, oftentimes after cancer surgery. He really shouldn't be a part of this case, and we shouldn't be here today. This case is a fraud case that was filed by Crestview against a woman named Mary Armstrong, alleging that Crestview's $500,000 investment in a company founded by Ms. Armstrong was misused and was spent for personal gain. Dr. Smith has no connection to Crestview whatsoever, and his only connection to this case is that he did some consulting work on the new Vivo product during its development. Now, after Crestview sued Ms. Armstrong, alleging the fraudulent misuse of its investment, Dr. Smith was deposed along with several other witnesses. Then, after that deposition, subsequently Crestview and Ms. Armstrong reached a settlement. And that settlement generally was going to allow Ms. Armstrong to buy Crestview out, pay its investment back, the suit would be dismissed, and the parties would go on their ways. Unfortunately, Ms. Armstrong didn't have and was not able to secure the funding for that settlement agreement, at which point it fell through. The lawsuit kind of picked back up, and Crestview went in search of deeper pockets. And so what they did was they sued Dr. Smith, and they alleged that Dr. Smith committed securities fraud as an aider, that he aided Ms. Armstrong in deceiving Crestview into investing into her company. And now no one who really looks at the facts of this case could believe that Dr. Smith is guilty of securities fraud. He was added because he's a plastic surgeon, and they thought he had enough money to buy their investment back out. The allegations they made against Dr. Smith were, one, that he was intimately involved in developing and testing the product, and that he assisted Ms. Armstrong in her search for investors in the company. Now, those two things necessarily involve communications between Dr. Smith and Mary Armstrong, as well as Dr. Smith's right to associate with Mary Armstrong. And those, we know, are both rights that are protected by the Texas Citizens Participation Act. And so, because those rights were involved, Dr. Smith moved to dismiss in the trial court. And the court's well aware of the standard that first a showing needs to be made that the communications involve the right to free speech and the right to association. And then the burden shifts to the plaintiff, who must then provide clear and specific evidence for each element of the cause of action that they're asserting. So a hearing was held on Dr. Smith's motion in the district court, and the district court failed to rule within the statutorily prescribed time, and so the motion was overruled by operation of law. Later on, the court did issue a written order denying the motion, but that was after it had already been overruled by operation of law. So really, there are two main issues on this appeal. The first is that if the evidence shows Dr. Smith was communicating with Mary Armstrong about matters related to health, safety, the efficacy of a medical product, you know, does that involve the protections of the TCPA in a claim for aider liability under the Texas Securities Act? We believe it does. And so the second issue is then, at the trial court, did Crestview meet its burden to show clear and specific evidence of each element of the cause of action it asserted against Dr. Smith?
Your opponent says this isn't a matter of communication, it's a matter of doing.
Correct.
So it's not talking, but it's doing. That's the gist of the lawsuit.
Correct. And there's actually two responses to that. The first is that it's just an artful way to plead around the fact that what he testified and what we showed in the trial court Dr. Smith actually did was communicate with her, essentially just consult with her and tell her how this has to be done, what different things you might do.
Everything in this world depends on communication. You can't get anything done, I don't think, without some communication occurring, at least between two different minds.
Correct. Okay?
There has to be some ability to communicate a thought. And so are you taking the position that there simply are no limits on the TCPA, that everything is a communication?
Not necessarily, but this does arise out of is related to, even if it were an action, it arises out of or relates to communications between Dr. Smith and Mary Armstrong about the health, safety, efficacy of that product.
So anytime you have two co-conspirators communicating about whatever nefarious purpose that they may have, let's just assume in a hypothetical case they do, that's protected by the TCPA?
The Austin Court of Appeals and actually said that that is exactly what the law is in Craig versus Tejas Promotions.
Well, the Austin Court of Appeals also said a few weeks later in Sullivan versus Texas Ethics Commission that it's only protection to the maximum extent permitted by law, and that you cannot consider the TCPA in a vacuum. You have to look as to what the effect would be of saying it protects everything. It protects every communication, don't they?
It doesn't protect every communication, but it does protect communications related to health or safety, which is what occurred in this case. And
well, isn't a conspiracy to kill someone related to health or safety?
I mean, if you're I don't think it would protect an illegal act like that. For instance, like the example you just gave, a murder. But if it were people communicating about the development of a product, or what the Supreme Court says is the provision of medical services by a healthcare professional, then it is protected.
Mr. Wiles, I want to look at the basic testimony, and it's my understanding that Ms. Armstrong testified and said to the investor decision maker that Dr. Smith had injected her with this product.
Correct.
On two separate occasions. And there was nothing in the evidence, or in your brief at least, about contradictory evidence as to whether Dr. Smith did that or not. What's in the brief is, well, we can't talk about this because it's HIPAA-related. And then there was some testimony that the effects of the drug were felt to be positive on the part of Ms. Armstrong. Now, your doctor did not refute that in his opportunity to testify before the trial court in making his case. Now, was any of that I said incorrect from what the record shows?
No, Your Honor. And when he was asked that question at his deposition, he was a non-party to the underlying suit at that time, and he was sitting for his deposition by agreement. Immediately before that deposition began, Ms. Armstrong filed objections under HIPAA, objecting to any testimony one way or the other about her medical history, period. And so at his deposition, with those pending objections that were unresolved, he was instructed not to answer those questions.
And so as a matter of what the record shows, he did not refute her testimony that she had had two occasions in which she was injected with the product by Dr. Smith in his office.
No, there's no direct contradiction to that testimony in the record. But what I would say is that this isn't a referendum on whether or not the injections happened or didn't. It's a securities fraud case. It's about alleged misrepresentations that Ms. Armstrong made to Crestview that Crestview alleges were facilitated by Dr. Smith.
And if Dr. Smith had not injected her, she would not have been able to say that and make representations or make any kind of reference to the procedures that she says he performed.
But in order for Dr. Smith to be liable, he would have had to have known when that occurred that he was materially assisting in a violation of securities law. So he would have had to know that by doing this, I'm going to allow her or I'm going to help her make misrepresentations to Crestview in order to get it to invest into that company.
And there's no evidence in the record as to his state of mind at the time that he did this. There is evidence that he was and Ms. Armstrong were the only two people in his office, no staff, and no record made.
That's the allegation that Ms. Armstrong made, yes.
And that's the evidence, isn't it?
That is the evidence in this case, yes.
All right. So the trial court judge had before him that amount of participation in the product itself in terms of looking at its effect on humans whenever he was making a decision as to the participation by Dr. Smith in this process, in this securities fraud case.
Yes, he had that testimony.
All right, now, let's go to the trip to Vegas. Dr. Smith went to Vegas with Ms. Armstrong. There wasn't any testimony that I saw that directly said the money came from the investment money, but that was the implication in terms of circumstantial. And if he did that, then he did participate and at least use a part of the money that was received, the $500,000.
Well, I think the trip to Vegas is a red herring, Your Honor, and that's because that happened after the investment. So anything that would be relevant to whether or not Dr. Smith was guilty of securities fraud would have had to have occurred prior to Crestview's investment. That happened afterwards, so it could not be legally the basis for a claim of securities fraud. But second, it's also not correct that they went to Las Vegas together. They were both there for a conference, the American College of Plastic Surgeons, I believe. And Dr. Smith was among a group of doctors, plastic surgeons, that Ms. Armstrong purchased drinks for and entertained while at that conference.
And, of course, those things were not brought out in the trial court because this is a very preliminary status of this litigation.
It is.
Instead of there being full discovery and determination of everything that happened as between Dr. Smith and Ms. Armstrong, this is a cutoff in terms of this stops at the one deposition taken preliminary to him even being a party to the lawsuit, and that's the effect of the Anti-SLAPP Act, is we cut things off at a point before there is full discovery. So the kind of things you're talking about is just what the purpose of the trip was and why people went and who did what, that's not developed in the record.
I think that was developed in the reporter's record at the hearing. I believe that was discussed. Now that it didn't have.
And how is that not at least some recognition on the part of Dr. Smith that a sum of money had been invested into NuV?
There was no evidence whatsoever that Dr. Smith knew the source of those funds at all. There was absolutely no evidence that he knew that they were Crestview's funds versus Ms. Armstrong's personal funds. He had absolutely no idea, and they offered no evidence to show that Dr. Smith knew that he was participating in the expenditure of these invested funds.
Well, did he pay for any of this trip?
He paid for his whole trip. He met her along with several other physicians out for drinks that night. She didn't purchase a ticket out there. They didn't stay together in the hotel. They met out for drinks so she could present this product to a number of different people.
Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Still have time. You've got a green light.
Okay, thank you. Now, I think as we've hit on, I don't believe that you could develop a product, and the evidence that the trial court had before it at the time was that Dr. Smith's involvement wasn't just limited to this alleged injection, but that he discussed safety, he discussed efficacy, he discussed different types of treatment that could be administered, different ways of activating it. He also discussed his experience with wound care, and all of those things were implicated. That was all before the trial court. So it's not just they're trying to limit it to a single injection that allegedly took place. There were a number of other things that are involved with Dr. Smith's involvement in the development of this product. I also don't believe, I think the court should focus as well on really the gist of what this action is. It's a securities law, an alleged misrepresentation case against Dr. Smith. It's not about the ejections. And so I think the court should keep in mind all of the facts and all of the circumstances and not just the one allegation where they're trying to limit it to an act. There were communications that were going on between the two parties the entire time, as well as implicating their right to association, which has to do with their business relationship to develop and distribute this product I think that's also implicated by the TCPA. That evidence was also before the trial court and wasn't ever really refuted by Crestview. They never said that his right to association was somehow not implicated, because it was. It had to do with protected communications in order to bring this product to market.
Well, the Supreme Court has said that a plaintiff's petition is the best and all-sufficient evidence of the nature of the action. But you want us to go far beyond what their petition says.
Well, the petition says that he was intimately involved in the development of the product and that he was
by injecting her twice.
They don't specify that. They say by, among other things, doing that injection. And it's not limited to, they don't only restrict their petition to that. That only occurred later, after the motion to dismiss was filed. So the petition is broader. It alleges that he was intimately involved with the development, doesn't restrict that to only the injection. And it also claims that he assisted her in her search for investors. Now, we did raise that in the trial court, and they presented no evidence that Dr. Smith was even aware that Ms. Armstrong was selling securities. There's no evidence whatsoever that he knew that she was getting an investor or Crestview to give her money at whatsoever, or the source of the funds that were used in any expenses that she incurred. So I've got a red light, but if you have any further questions.
Thank you for your presentation, Ms. Wiles. Yes, counsel, if you're ready.
Your Honor, may it please the court, my name is Brian Davis, and I represent the appellee in this case, the plaintiff below, Crestview NUV LLC, on its own behalf and derivatively on behalf of Nuvivo Bioscience Solutions LLC. I understand that Your Honors are familiar with the facts. I would like to go into just a very brief discussion of some of the facts that I think are relevant that were not discussed in the appellant's argument. This case began after Ms. Armstrong had worked with Dr. Smith. And as Your Honor knows, had been injected by Dr. Smith. There had been sort of a clandestine testing of the product at Dr. Smith's office. And prior to that, and also after that, that testing occurred in 2006 and in 2016 and in 2017. Meeker, who is a representative of Crestview in this case, was approached by Ms. Armstrong in early 2017, and he was given all of the representations related to the product, not only that she had been injected with the product and that it had been successful, but also various other representations, such as that the product had been tested at Stanford, that the product was not regulated by the FDA in the manner that a drug would be regulated by the FDA, that the company that he was investing in, NUV, was debt-free. And after Mr. Meeker's company, Crestview, invested in this product, there was another injection purportedly performed in 2017 on Ms. Armstrong. And in addition to that, after the investment was made, there was a $500,000 investment that was made in early 2017 by Crestview. Following that investment is when Ms. Armstrong took those funds and used those funds not only to go to Las Vegas, but she also wrote a $100,000 check to her mother. She paid her rent to the tune of a little over $4,000 every month for an apartment that she had in downtown Fort Worth. And it wasn't until 6 months later that all of this was discovered. When it was discovered, the total amount that was not used for business purposes was over $230,000. That was when Crestview immediately went to the trial court and received a temporary restraining order to prevent Ms. Armstrong from doing anything else with those funds. There was a strong concern that she didn't have the ability to repay the funds that had been already used, and that the remaining funds could be to be used as well. During the process of preparing for the temporary injunction hearing is when Dr. Smith was deposed. And so during that time, Ms. Armstrong was deposed, and she testified as to all those things that are in the record. And then Dr. Smith was deposed. When Dr. Smith was deposed, he objected to testifying as to the injections and as to several other issues that came up in his deposition related to his involvement in Nuvivo. And what was concerning about that, there were three things that were concerning about that. First of all, Ms. Armstrong had already testified as to all of this. This wasn't a secret. This wasn't a case of we were deposing a doctor about what a patient, what a procedure had been performed on a patient, and the patient had no idea. She was a party to the lawsuit and had already testified as to all these things that Dr. Smith had done. Second, a protective order had already been entered into the case, and the case law is clear that HIPAA does not apply to prevent the disclosure of information by a doctor if there is a protective order in place already in the case. In fact, that even applies if there's been a protective order asked for in the case. But in this case, there had been one signed, it was already entered, and Ms. Armstrong had already testified to all this on her own. The third thing that was very concerning about Dr. Smith's refusal to testify about what he did in connection with Nuvivo is that it was asked, did you inject Ms. Armstrong at all? And he said, I won't answer. And he's now said in his brief, I believe in his opening brief, he made mention of he didn't ever inject Ms. Armstrong whatsoever. Well, if the concern was HIPAA, him testifying that he did not ever perform any procedure on anyone, and the question was asked in broad form as well, have you ever injected a Nuvi product on anyone, in anyone? And he refused to answer that. And now he claims the answer is no. There would be no reason to refuse to answer that question if the answer was no and HIPAA was his main concern in not answering that question. The reason all that is important is when we get to the notion of not only were communications involved, but when we get down the road to the issue of, okay, if communications were involved, has the plaintiff produced a primary or prima facie showing of a aid or liability under the Texas Securities Act? We have case law that goes into great detail about the notion that there is no ability to look in someone's mind and determine their intent. And so what we need to look at is surrounding circumstances. We cited in the Appellee's brief a case from this court, W.L. Lindman Operating Co., Inc. v. Strange. That was 256 Southwest 3rd, 766. Of course, a case out of this court in 2009 where the petition was denied. And this court stated in that case, fraud is usually not discernible by direct evidence and is usually so covert or attendant with such attempts at concealment as to be incapable of proof other than by circumstantial evidence. Motive, past conduct, and related wrongful acts are thus factors to be considered. So even if we were dealing with a communication in this case, which we're not, it's not alleged that there was a communication, and there has been no evidence presented that what is alleged is related to any communication that was put in the record. But even if that could be shown, this issue of not only did Dr. Smith do these tests according to Ms. Armstrong when no one was at the office, at a time when the office was closed. He did not keep any medical records of the procedure. And when he was asked about it and had every opportunity to explain whether this had happened, whether he'd had anything to do with this, he would not answer. And his excuse for failing to answer doesn't make any sense.
Well, his lawyer told him not to answer. People follow their lawyer's advice now.
And I understand that. I believe that the issue, however, is I understand he's following his lawyer's advice. His lawyer is familiar with all of this, too. And, of course, I don't know what his lawyer and he are discussing. But to the extent his lawyer's giving him advice in this regard, there can clearly be an inference that there's some reason that they don't want to answer this question. And on the record in the deposition, it was discussed with the attorneys as all of these issues, you know, all of these things that were just raised as to why HIPAA didn't apply was discussed on the record with absolutely no explanation by the attorneys as to why there wouldn't be a response. But that gets into the second, sort of the second prong. The first prong dealing with was there a communication at issue. I think that your honors are right on point when we get to the fact that, well, is there ever a situation where a communication would not be at issue and the TCPA would not apply? The courts have made clear that in a situation where there is no direct communication, there is no application of the TCPA. And I want to address a couple of things that were raised in the reply brief. First of all, the allegation was made in the argument was made in the reply brief that this was some type of artful pleading. And the case that was cited in that was Boudry v. Humphreys, a case out of this court from August of this year. That case was actually a case that was a defamation claim, and it was filed by a pro se defendant, and then on appeal, after the defamation case had been dismissed, he complained about a fraud claim that he had brought at a later time. It wasn't in his original petition, but it was later filed and before the motion to dismiss was heard. And in addressing that, it had nothing to do with whether there was an artful pleading around the TCPA. Instead, the sixth issue, Boudry contends that the trial court erred in not finding common law fraud for the reason there is evidence in the record to support a finding that Appley made representations. This pro se defendant was actually making an argument that there were representations made, and the court noted that Boudry's briefing on this issue, however, references defamation per se and not common law fraud. The court goes on to explain that whatever label he places on his cause of action, he is seeking defamation damages, and so we're going to look at, you know, the totality of what he's pled. This notion that there's some artful pleading around it is simply not the case. The other thing I'd like to address is this notion that the right of association is somehow implicated and that therefore there's not a communication. The TCPA plainly defines the right of association as a communication. The communication or the right of association in the TCPA is defined at section 27.001 subsection 2. And it plainly defines it as a communication. So this is not an issue where there's some right of association between Dr. Smith and Ms. Armstrong and that they don't have to show that there was some communication at issue. They do, even if this, if their basis of their motion to dismiss is the right of association. With respect to whether there was a pleading that mentions communications, the petition is laid out, and the only portion in which Dr. Smith is mentioned in that petition is on paragraphs 12 and 47, and that relevant portion of the petition is laid out on pages 12 through 13 of the appellee's brief. Just those two paragraphs are laid out. in that, it is alleged that Dr. Smith was intimately involved in the development and testing of the product. And then it goes on to explain down below that he was injecting her with the product. It was also raised at the oral argument and in the court below, and Ms. Armstrong testified that they were also romantically involved. And this notion that there was an intimate involvement in the testing and the development of the product is a, you know, that there was sort of a kind way to plead what was happening between Dr. Armstrong, Dr. Smith and Ms. Armstrong. So this notion that, well, he was intimately involved somehow means that he had, that he's being sued for his communications is simply not true. And I believe the petition lays that out very clearly. The other mention in the reply brief is that, well, there is one sentence that says that he searched for an investor. He assisted her with her search for an investor. It does not explain, and nor was there any evidence presented by Dr. Smith, that that occurred as a result of some communication. There could easily be assistance in seeking an investor, whether that's financial assistance, he paid for some expenses she had, he drove her to the meeting that he had with an investor. There are all types of assistance that could be rendered, and it is their burden, it is Dr. Smith's burden, to connect the allegations in the petition with a communication that is at issue, and he did not do that. And the only evidence that was put in the record by Dr. Smith was a 4-page excerpt from his deposition.
Your time is up, Mr. Davis. I appreciate your presentation, and thank you for your argument here today.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is there a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Just very briefly, we got kind of a laundry list of alleged misdeeds by Ms. Armstrong, that she took this money and paid this rent and paid her ex-husband and for her parents' car. And we're not denying that maybe that occurred, maybe it didn't. None of those involve Dr. Smith, and none of those involve a securities fraud by Dr. Smith. And that's one of the real issues that we have with their response to this appeal, is that they've only made, with regard to a Securities Act violation, very specific allegations that she testified, or she alleged that the product had been tested at Stanford when it hadn't, that it was a human and cell-based tissue product when it wasn't, it was ready for market when it wasn't. None of those alleged violations of the Securities Act involve Dr. Smith in any way. They don't involve the injection in any way. So all of the alleged, the first element for a case for aid or liability under the Securities Act is that there's a primary violation. So you have to connect Ms. Armstrong's violation with Dr. Smith, who had to have been aware of it. Then there's a very specific standard, the general awareness standard. He had to have that state of mind when he engaged in the conduct. He had to have rendered substantial assistance to her. There are a whole number of things that had to have occurred that didn't occur, and they didn't offer any evidence of any of those, either in the trial court below or in the appeal. I also want to talk about somehow Dr. Smith's refusal to answer questions at his deposition being some evidence of some bad intent on his part. He was a non-party to this litigation. He was not present at her deposition or any other deposition, nor was his attorney. And so walking in an hour before his deposition and being handed objections under HIPAA, his response and my response was, if you look at the record, I think he quite clearly said, look, just leave me out of it until you get it sorted out. And so until there was some effort on behalf of Crestview, and maybe it was an improper objection under HIPAA, but merely walking in as a non-party, Dr. Smith had no idea that that was the case. And it's actually Crestview's burden to have gotten those objections heard and resolved if they wanted Dr. Smith to answer those questions at his deposition.
Now, Crestview didn't have, it was not Crestview, it was Armstrong who filed who brought HIPAA into the case.
Exactly.
And so there's some burden in your mind on the part of Crestview to have addressed that issue in advance of the time that Armstrong's attorney raised it at the time of his deposition?
I think it was. It's certainly not evidence that Dr. Smith had anything to hide or was attempting to hide anything. He's going in there and someone is asserting an objection under HIPAA and under her privacy rights that asked him not to answer specific questions.
It was a general question saying you never injected anyone, did you?
Well, what was going on was I can't get it through the front door, so I'll try and get it through the back door, and I'll ask you, Phil, did you inject it? Did you not inject it? And there was a series of questions that we're trying to get to the answer by kind of through the back door, and there was discussion on the record. If you look at the record, her attorney was strenuously objecting the entire time. There's pages of back and forth between Crestview's attorney and Ms. Armstrong's attorney, and Dr. Smith is caught in the middle. And I think when that objection under HIPAA is made, it's the duty of the person making that objection and Crestview to have that sorted out before Dr. Smith can testify. It's not his right or his obligation to decide whether it's a valid objection or it's an invalid objection.
Okay, well, you want to say you just got hit with it when you got there. They got served with the motion right when they got there, didn't they?
Yes, or
so
immediately
they couldn't
before.
Have had it sorted out.
Well, the deposition could have been postponed. The judge could have been called and got on the phone and asked to rule on an objection. There was no problem doing that in several other occasions. But the point is that it's walking into the deposition. It's not a non-party's right or role to make that decision as to whether or not this objection is proper or improper. That's the judge's function. And I think it would have been imperative on Crestview if they wanted to have those answers to get that objection heard and ruled on. And then Dr. Smith would have answered the question or the objection would have been sustained. But as it stands, walking in and being given an objection is not evidence of some sort of malintent on his part. And I think they're trying to phrase it that way or to focus it that way. But he was instructed to answer until that objection was resolved. I also don't think that refusal in the face of an objection is some sort of clear and specific evidence of securities fraud. I think it's clear and specific evidence that he was instructed by his attorney not to answer until the court had a chance to take a look at the issue. And the court ruled one way or the other, and that was really his only point. And if you look at the quotes that are in the appellate brief, you can see that's exactly what he said. I don't have a dog in this fight. Just leave me out of it till you get it sorted out. So I think that's the only evidence that's before the court. And my red light is gone.
Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
And we will accept your argument and consider that submitted for your case. Each of you, thank you for your argument and your appearance here before the court today.